Talk 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM. Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Tuesday the 22nd of March and this is Game On. Coming up today, we'll be great in 28. Tony O'Donoghue has the latest as Ireland looks set to co-host the Euros.
The four football associations in the UK and Ireland are confident that they will be confirmed as joint hosts of the tournament later this week, with no rival bid expected before tomorrow's deadline.
In racing, he brought syndicate success to Ireland with his Cheltenham win on Flooring Porter, so we're going to catch up with jockey Danny Mullins.
In athletics, David Gillick is just back from the World Indoors in Belgrade. He'll be in studio to review the action for us. And in European football, we'll find out if a Barcelona revival is underway. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
I was reading Xavi's tweet the other night after Barcelona beat Real Madrid 4-0, Marie, and he was, you know, we've an outside chance of winning the title. And then I started looking at the leaderboard. It's like they're so far behind. I know he was looking at the scoreline of the result in the Bernabeu, but I think he needed to look at the other list as well, where they're 12 points adrift.
He was probably trying to stay on message, though, you know, like
he was really on message. Not sure which
message.
Keep
motivation going, keep the fans coming, keep the dream alive. Yeah.
Keep the dream alive is right.
But anyway,
you have to have ambition, don't you?
Absolutely. Now, speaking of ambition, Tony O'Donoghue is with us on the line. Tony, it looks like the Euros are going to come to Ireland.
It looks like you've been sloganeering already. Have you won a competition already? It's going to be great in 28. Oh my goodness.
That's Ronan Lawler now, our producer, has came up with that. I just delivered it perfectly.
Yeah, is it going to be great?
Well, you tell us, Tony. You are on the ground. What is the reaction like?
I'm right near the Aviva Stadium as we speak, and it is a lovely, shiny piece of infrastructure. There's no doubt about that. But remember, when we were due to host some of the games in Euro 2020, and we only didn't host them in the end because of COVID, I mean, we won that bid, if you like. This stadium here, this beautiful shiny stadium, had to be upgraded to reach UEFA standards. So it has been upgraded. The likes of the screens and various things inside the stadium. But 2028 will be 8 years later since the last upgrade. It's 6 years from now. So a lot of money will have to go into that. The minister I know today was saying that we have, you know, the infrastructure already in the stadium, Aviva Stadium and Croke Park. But to reach UEFA standards, Croke Park is going to require a lot of investment. And, you know, there is an aspect of this where money will have to be spent from a football tournament to upgrade a GAA stadium, which to some people seems bonkers. There's a lot of people as well saying that, you know, what Ireland needs, you know, less than, you know, half a mile away from here probably, Tolka Park falling down on its knees. You know, Dalymount Park is due to be redeveloped, but even that's in doubt. You know, it's not the big shiny new stadia and the big shiny tournaments that we need, but rather, you know, proper investment in infrastructure. Now, Stephen Kenny said today, although he completely understands the view of the sceptical, and in some respects I got the sense that he agrees with it, but he's hoping that, you know, you can coexist, you can, he doesn't know the costs and what it's going to take to run this, but you can get more infrastructure, get more funds for grassroots football because of hosting an event like this. It looks like we're there, if you like, in the absence of another bid. I know that the English wanted the Irish involved because of our soft political power at UEFA level. But if this doesn't need to come to a vote, as we'll find out tomorrow, the deadline for submissions of interest is close of business tomorrow. If there's only one bid, which is the UK and Ireland bid, well, it's likely to get through. We'll know that, as I say, by late tomorrow. Then UEFA publish a bid book, which is where they say exactly what they need, and that's where the money will be totted up, because, you know, there are implications for the Irish state, you know, security and policing, fan zones, public transport, and wait till we tell all the people of Europe that there's no train from our only airport in Dublin into the Aviva Stadium or Croke Park.
That is the interesting part, Tony, but this is Ireland getting the Euros, but is it really just Dublin getting the Euros? Aviva, Croke Park, what about the rest
of
the country?
Look,
There's
a Northern Ireland dimension as well, because of course Northern Ireland are one of the football associations involved in the bid, but Windsor Park is too small. It's an 18,500 capacity venue. And Casement Park, well, you know, there's plans for its redevelopment. It's a GAA stadium. And will it be done in 6 years' time, you know, when there isn't a sod turned yet? So, you know, I'm delighted that a big event can come to Ireland, and particularly as the Euro 2020 was within our grasp and COVID let it slip. But there has to be a long-term legacy from events like this. It can't be just the shiny baubles, as the glittering house on the hill, as Aidan O'Riordan, the Labour spokesman, put it earlier. It has to be something that will have a lasting legacy on all sport in this country.
And is there any rumours, Tony, as to what way this will be carved up? How many games Ireland might get? Could we have a quarter-final or a semi-final, or is this just all up in the air and we'll see what happens after you win it?
Well, one of the reasons it's up in the air, I guess, is because UEFA haven't made it clear yet whether it will be like Germany, the next European Championships, a 24-team tournament, or whether, and a lot of indications are that they want to expand it to 32 teams. And obviously that'll, you know, change the nature of how many groups, how many games, and how many stadia will be needed. But when you think about that, you know, UEFA, 54, 55 members, will Russia be allowed back in them? God knows, the war has changed everything anyway. And remember, Russia was one of the people who were likely to bid for the European Championships. They already hosted the last World Cup in 2018. And there was talk that they would be a rival bid, but obviously they're out of the equation now. Italy, which was considering a bid, the 2032 bid is needed for tomorrow as well. Italy has decided not to bid for 28 and is going to put all its eggs in the 32 basket. So the way seems to be clear, but how many games depends on how many teams. But it is odd, isn't it, that, you know, if there's 54 associations, over half of those people who start the qualifying campaign will actually make it to the finals.
And what about Ireland then? Will we have to qualify, or do we fall under the rule that if you're a host nation, you get in?
Again, I think it depends on UEFA's book bid, or bid book as they call it. But I would think it's most unlikely that you can have five nations qualifying automatically. I would say impossible. So you'd imagine that England won't worry about qualifying. Maybe Scotland and Wales won't either. But certainly Ireland and Northern Ireland will worry about qualification. I mean, it's a question I asked Stephen Kenny earlier today. I mean, as a football man, would he prefer a 32-team tournament or a 24-team tournament? And he thought about it because, you know, many people would think that the more teams you allow into the finals, there will be a dilution of quality. Now, the finals are big events, and, you know, they're social events as much as sporting events. But there's no doubt in my mind there's a diminution of quality the more teams that you let in. But having thought about it, Stephen went, well, you know, you'd be denying yourself an opportunity. And, you know, for smaller countries like Ireland or Northern Ireland or Wales or Iceland, to make it to the finals is a huge, big deal. We're nothing that we're used to, nothing that we come to expect. And 2028 would be the 40th anniversary of when, you know, we all went to, and the rest of us went to Stuttgart, or some of us that were around then.
Well, that's something anyway that you really could get behind if the anniversary of that was on, and, you know, you could make a big thing out of it. But look, Tony, as expected, government...
It's going to be great in 28.
It's going to be great in 28. That's going to stick now. Government have been reacting to this news, as you would expect. Jack Chambers, who is the Minister of State for Sport, was speaking to the media about it today. Let's hear from him.
So today the government has agreed to support the expression of interest for the Euro 2028 bid. It's an exciting event in 2028 across five different nations, and the football associations will tomorrow be submitting that expression of interest on behalf of the five nations. It's really positive that the government has got behind this. I think it presents huge economic, tourism and sporting opportunities for Ireland. We won't know until the close of business tomorrow to see what other bids might be submitted by other countries, but the update as of today is that the it, it could be that the UK and Ireland are is the only bid, but we'll have to wait and see until the final deadline closes tomorrow.
Jack Chambers speaking there. And I think, Tony, as well, it could be quite interesting, just given the fact that when people like Stephen Kenny are asked about this, Jack Chambers is saying they're putting their support behind the bid. But Stephen Kenny then comes out and in his press today says, you know, they need support for the structures and the grassroots as well. So the conversations do seem to be happening in tandem when it comes to the support that's needed around football, which is probably a positive, really.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Stephen Kenny today said overall he thinks it's positive to have the championships in Ireland, that our supporters will look forward to it. But he understood the view of those who might be sceptical. He said the football infrastructure in this country, as we all know, is nowhere near where it needs to be, apart from this shiny stadium behind me here, the Aviva, and perhaps Croke Park as well. But the Taoiseach, he said, has acknowledged that and has said publicly that he wants to see investment in academies. And acknowledging that isn't necessarily conflicting with hosting the Euro 2028, and that he does see it as a positive. And I think that's the way people will probably end up looking at it. But, you know, I understand the view of people who also feel, you know, are there as many tourism benefits? You know, when every big event, I've noticed as well that they started to say the European Championships is the second biggest sporting event in the world. I thought it was the Olympics and the World Cup, or the World Cup and the Olympics, but suddenly it seems to have gone into second place. And the amount of money that they always say that these events generate, well, I'm sceptical about those, because, you know, there's cost-benefit analysis has been done. It suggests a huge positive return, but the security cost could be anywhere between 26 and 35 million. That's been looked at by the department. And, you know, a cost-benefit analysis. We don't know what the world is going to be like in 2028. One thing we probably do know is that, you know, post this war, and hopefully it will end soon, there's probably going to be a recession in Europe. So the cost of everything can spiral. So don't want to be putting a downer on it or to be too negative. It's in Ireland, how many will we get? Frankly, I imagine the same as it was in 2020, which became 2021. Wembley Stadium, a cash cow for UEFA, will host the final and probably the semi-finals as well, because that's where they do all their corporate stuff. That's where they make their most money.
And just to, I think the line that has been dropped, Tony, out of the statement you just made was the second biggest soccer tournament in the world, which puts it ahead of the Copa America and the African Cup of Nations. I did read that. It's the second biggest soccer tournament rather than sporting event, whoever he's being creative with that one. But Tony, when you look then today, you're talking about the investment in the League of Ireland, investment in grassroots soccer in Ireland. What about the interest of the Comer Group in Galway United?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair to them, they have been involved in Galway for a long, long time now. They've been really good sponsors of the club. And it's great to see that. And you could say the same about Philip O'Doherty in Derry. You know, he recently sold his company and I think he's now officially a billionaire. Or Gareth Kelleher in St. Patrick's Athletic. You know, the League of Ireland has attracted investment, but not always the type, you know, the investment that you get from, you know, a vulture fund or whatnot. It's more to do with people who believe in the community aspect of the club and are also willing to put a few bob behind it. But, you know, these millionaires or these well-off people alone can't change the structure and the face of football in this country.
Tony, and just before we finish up on this, ticket sales for the Belgium and Lithuania games have been going really, really well, and surprisingly really well, really, and I think especially when you look at the team that Belgium are bringing.
Well, to be fair, the team that Belgium are bringing, while it doesn't have a De Bruyne or a Lukaku, it's, you know, anybody who's earned over 50 caps wasn't really considered, it still has a number of really top names. They're the number one ranked team in the world for a reason. You know, they keep winning matches. They've been so consistent. And their development for a small country, the way they have brought players forward over the years, and to be so consistent, I think they're going to provide really good opposition no matter who they put on the field. 48,000 tickets sold already. It's looking like a sellout for Saturday. And then even the game against Lithuania the following Tuesday, a school night, but nonetheless, 33,000 tickets sold already. And I think that's a reflection of people want to get back out to events. There's no doubt about that. That's a factor. But I think people have all, I mean, the fans at the Aviva in recent games have shown you know, voted with their feet and with their cheering and with their credit cards for paying their tickets, how much they support Stephen Kenny and this new generation of Irish footballers, if you like, a generation that reflects a new multicultural Ireland as well. And it's a very welcoming place, the Aviva Stadium, on big football nights. And I'm glad to say we'll have those on Saturday and again next Tuesday.
Very good. Tony O'Donoghue, thank you so much for joining us. We will talk to you again very, very soon. We're going to take a very quick break and then we're joined by Danny Mullins.
RTE
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. And all, well, not almost a week ago, last Thursday afternoon at the Cheltenham Festival, during the Paddy Power Stairs Hurdle, Danny Mullins produced what was probably arguably one of the most best human performances of the week aboard Florian Porter, and I'm delighted to say he joins us on the line now. Danny, congratulations, it was a massive day for you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's a big day and it's important to be winning on the big stage.
It sure is. I think we're going to start at the end rather than at the beginning, and we're going to roll on to the celebrations. It's been quite a while since I saw celebrations like it at the Cheltenham Festival. I don't ever remember being carried around the winner's enclosure like you were. They were unbelievable scenes.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. You know, the lads, you know, they missed out on the day last year. Like, they had big parties at home, but to be there this year in the mix of 70,000 plus crowd and really enjoying it, that was special for them.
How many of them were there? Because every camera angle was picking up the black and white scarves. They seemed to be multiplying as the end was nearing.
I think the whole west of Ireland might have been there from where I was. Anyway, there was a black and white scarf from every angle I could see once I got back into the winner's enclosure.
I think you could be after land in a minute, Danny. My memory of this time last year was lockdowns and people not allowed to go anywhere. So I think those parties were a bit delayed, were they, last year?
It might have been, but I think they drank a fair bit of porter anyway.
Yeah, he's well named. Look, and he is a fairy tale story. I mean, they bought him off the internet, off eBay, was it?
Facebook.
I think Facebook, yeah, for 5,000 and formed a syndicate. And I suppose that aspect of it really shows it can be done. You know, anybody can live the dream, make it to Cheltenham and mix it with the best.
Obviously, you got the ride at the 11th hour last year when you got on him and Jonathan Moore got injured, and you've kept the ride since. But it hasn't been plain sailing this season with him. He fell in Navan, the start didn't go right at Leopardstown. Were you ever feeling a bit of pressure from them, or were they always on side with you?
No, they were always on side. You know, it probably wasn't the smoothest season up to now, but in the few weeks leading up to Cheltenham, the few days I'd sat the horse for Gavin, he was very pleased with him. The work he was showing us was fairly good, and we were optimistic going into a very competitive race, but we knew we had a good chance of winning.
I thought the start might be a bit of an issue for him. He is a bit hot and a bit racy, a classical dream in there, Paisley Park, who can be less than enthusiastic. Did you think you would be as smooth 100 metres into the tape and the way he lined up? Did you think you would get it that easy?
I was hoping I would, you know. I suppose I had plan A to Z in my head of things going wrong, but in fairness to the horse, you know, as soon as I got on him, he was chilled out beforehand, the crowds didn't affect him, he went down to the start, like, very relaxed, and, you know, I just got in, it was plan A all the way, and nothing went wrong, so I was delighted with that.
Nothing did go wrong, but I think the part that really impressed me and many people was how you were able to control the race in the last 6 furlongs from the top of the hill. Did you really believe when you took back to run down the hill, 6 furlongs to go, 2 hurdles to jump, that nobody would come and challenge you?
I was thinking somebody might try and do it to me, but I was quite happy, you know, getting to steady it up, jumped the second last, I could hear them right on my tail and still hadn't seen anybody appear. And, you know, that new course in Cheltenham, you come off the bend, you make a line for the outside rail, and a peek at the big screen, I could see they were banging my tail, but it was a great feeling knowing I had a lot of petrol to pick up and race up the hill.
You had a second look at the big screen. How much did you see?
I could see 3 or 4 of them on my tail. The first look at the screen, I knew there was a good few of them there, and the second look, I was keeping an eye out for Paul on Classical Dream. I thought he was going to be the one that was closing me down while he got onto my tail. They just didn't really land the blow at him.
When you jump, I know he hangs a bit to his left. Obviously, you had a lot of pressure on your right hand going to the last hurdle. You jumped well. But when he landed, did you just react by sticking your left hand on the right rein?
It was, you know, he jumped left. It's funny, last year I was expecting him to go left and he ducked right. He just has his own little mind on what he wants to do. And yeah, I took a pull to the right. It just wasn't enough. He was still going, so I just had to get my left hand across onto that right rein to guide him up the hill. I think he wanted to go out for another circuit, but that wasn't part of my plan.
It most certainly wasn't. And one last technical question. Why didn't you have your whip in your left hand?
Because last year he went right.
That'll do. Someone else asked me that and why I didn't pick you up on it, but you've given the answer and I hope they're listening.
So, Danny, now that Ruby has asked you all the technical questions, I want to know, did you go out with them afterwards? Is that what happened, all the lads?
I didn't know. I had a nice ride in the Gold Cup the next day, so it was home to bed early for me. So hopefully soon enough I might get to enjoy a bit of a party with all the syndicate.
I'd say you get a hero's welcome now if you go west.
That would be nice, all right, you know, with the hard work done. But he might run again this season, so we'll enjoy this one for now and keep looking forward as well.
Ruby, did you prefer riding for a syndicate or just one owner? It's more pressure.
I don't need any more pressure, Marie. The only thing is you probably have more answers to give when you come back in. If you're riding for one person and they hear what you say, they move on. Whereas you can be riding for a syndicate, the five standing immediately around you might have heard what you said, but everybody else in the background won't, and they'll have to repeat yourself a few times. That's what I find anyway.
And people will have been watching Flooring Porter and everyone will think, wow, if they can do it, why can't I do it? I could maybe find a horse on Facebook and end up getting a winner in Cheltenham. But like, what's the cost like? So if you do go down that road...
Danny, you are more involved with the owning of horses than I am.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I suppose different trainers have their different fees and that. I think they'd average anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 a month, and you know, jockey fees are set across the board. But you know, you want to get your horse, find a good trainer, and keep the dream alive.
And yeah, and that's, Marie, probably why Irish Racing is enjoying such a success at the moment, is because of the value of prize money here. So if you can get a horse to win a race in Ireland, just any race, it will break the back on what your yearly expenses will be. It won't get you through the year, but it'll make it quite minimal compared to in the UK, where the prize money is so small and the training fees are higher and travel costs are even more. So that's a huge thing for the ownership in racing at the moment. It makes sense to have financially have horses in Ireland. But Danny, look, you did mention you had a good ride in the Gold Cup on Tornado Flyer, whom you won the King George on there a while ago. Things didn't really go to plan for him.
No, he never really got into the same rhythm that he found around Kempton, and was just a little bit disappointed on the day, but maybe something might show up afterwards. It just wasn't to be. He pulled up after and he'll go again.
It must have been great to be back there though with crowds. He had rides every day, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. The atmosphere, the build up, the excitement, it probably brought Cheltenham back to what it should be.
Yeah, definitely, you know, and while I thoroughly enjoyed last year, it was, you know, a different feel about Cheltenham this year with 70,000 plus record-breaking crowds. So many Irish were over there as well, and you know, so many of my friends had a couple of days off work with the bank holiday the way it fell as well. So yeah, that really brought to it.
Obviously, Wednesday was a monsoon day. I used to love riding in the rain. Did it bother you? Did you enjoy it? I know everyone who was there as a spectator found it a difficult day.
Yeah, it didn't bother me. You know, there was plenty of rain. It actually suited some of the horses I rode on Wednesday. The bit of rain helped. I think on Tuesday the ground was getting fairly dry, so you know, the bit of rain was welcome to keep things right for later in the week.
And looking outside of Flooring Porter, there were some huge performances there. Obviously Constitution Hill and Sir Gerhard, the big novices. Which horses stood out for you?
I suppose it's the easy one to say is Honeysuckle. You know, she just keeps getting the job done. She's never that fashion or flash, I suppose, but she has a great habit of winning, and no matter what they throw at her, she seems to get home and ahead of them.
Do you think Constitution Hill will come to Punchestown to take her on?
That'll be a decision they'll have to make later
later and closer to the time. But if I had him, I think I'd keep him again the novices for the moment and take her on next year.
And could you see anything from the novice chasers that might go and take on a Blue Tar? I mean, I thought he was brilliant in the Gold Cup.
He was, and, you know, a big performance, you know, reversed the form with Manila Indo last year. It'll be interesting to see Gallop and the Champ. You know, he's a very unlucky faller. I think he showed he has an unbelievable amount of talent. And, you know, I think he could be in the mix next year. Venetia Williams' horse was also very good, Le Home Press. So, you know, with a few exciting novices coming through, they'll definitely shake it up a bit.
Obviously, Cheltenham isn't the end of the season. It may well be the highlight, but it's on to Aintree next, just over a fortnight now to the Grand National. Have you anything lined up, Danny? Are you looking forward to anything at Aintree?
Nothing set in stone yet. Willie has a good few horses in the Grand National, and there's a possibility of Florin Porter looking at Aintree. It being left-handed, I couldn't see him going to Punchestown. He's not as good going right-handed. So Aintree would be a possibility if he comes out of Cheltenham well, and that'd be nice if he went there.
Big pot, big race. Yeah, that would be ideal. Big, follow the big bucks path. It's been done many times before. Danny, thanks a million for taking our call. Well done last week. I know there's no rest for the wicked. You're probably in Clonmel this afternoon and somewhere else tomorrow. But do get yourself west and enjoy that party.
I will do. I'm sitting down to watch the Bahrain Grand Prix as we speak.
That's over. Do you want to know the result?
I know, a fair idea, but I want to check what happened in between.
Thanks,
Best
Danny.
Of luck.
See you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. I'm delighted to say that David Gillick is with us, well, with me in studio. Ruby's down in Kildare still. David, you haven't been in for, I'd say, about 2 years.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen you in about 2 years, almost as long as I hadn't seen Ruby for.
I hope she gave you as much stick as she gave me.
I am just about to, Ruby. You're looking very slim, very fit. What's going on?
Yeah, well, I'm 39 this year, so I don't know. Is that, does that fall into the midlife crisis category? I don't know.
It depends. Are you wearing lycra or not?
Mammal, middle-aged man in lycra. I'm going to do the Dublin Marathon this year. So I've been up in the miles, which is coming from my background, sprinting background. I've just been running a lot more now and looking forward to it.
So you're doing it in October, and yeah, we're in March now. So you're doing a lot of training.
I'm doing a good bit. And I suppose I have contacts in the know. So I went to one or two of them and was like, right here, help me out. One of them is actually Emmett Dunleavy, who coaches Darragh McElhenney, who we'll probably talk about, who competed in Belgrade over the weekend. But Emmett did a bit of lactate testing, without getting too technical, you know, a bit of lactate testing, see what he was working with, see what he was dealing with. And as a sprinter, I'm literally producing lactate, not even training, which is not a good thing when you're trying to run a marathon. So that's why I needed to start early. So I've got to get a little bit more efficient, get the heart rate down and get the miles in, which I'm finding, I'm actually, you know, I have to say, right, I'm enjoying running, you know, because I'm going at a slower pace. So usually it was all like really heavy, really hard, intense work. So I'm enjoying just going out and running along at like 5 minute K pace for now and just try and improve on that. The main thing is, Marie, is that I finish it.
Yeah, right. I get a feeling this is you.
Right, the truth be told, my sister.
The truth be told is, you might be 39, but you're going to try and run probably sub 3:30, maybe 3:15. You have in your head to be as competitive as you can possibly be, so be honest with yourself.
I think you're actually in my head, because my sister ran 3:26 a couple of years ago, so I have to beat that.
So it went from the most important thing is that I finish it, to I'm going to be 3:26.
Let's
just
call a spade
quickly.
A spade here, you know.
The lies of a sports person. Oh yeah, talk yourself down, but you know, in your own head, I have to do this.
Ruby was laughing the whole way through your marathon spiel there now, I have to say. Right, well, you may update us though over the next few months how you're getting on.
Yeah, yeah. I'll keep you informed. Yeah,
a little marathon diary, that'd be good. The sprinter turned long distance runner. Interesting. Doesn't happen too often.
Imagine if you do run a really, really good time and you realise now that you weren't really a sprinter at all.
It was the wrong event. I know. Could you imagine? Wasted all that time.
There's so many layers to this. David Gillick doing the marathon. I'm going to really enjoy it.
Yeah, what have I let myself in for?
Get me through the next.
This isn't
six
why
months.
I came in here.
No,
by
it's
the way.
Not. We did come in to talk athletics, and a lot of it being sprint athletics. So let's look back at the Euros, or the Euros, the World Indoors that were on in Belgrade. And let's start with the positive. So the positive was Sarah Lavin reaching a world final. We've had her on the show. Her story is unbelievable. She was a brilliant junior, had the world at her feet, hampered by injury, was compared to Dervla Rorick all the time. Hadn't until this weekend really reached her potential. And what age is she now?
That's a good question. I think she's just late 20s, 27, 28.
To reach a world final. So she did really well.
Yeah, she did. It was like, you know, I think in athletics, when you have someone that medals at a Euro Juniors, we're very quick to kind of label them the next great whoever, and you know, everyone gets invested in that journey. And it's a really, really difficult thing for any young sports person to transition from a junior into a senior. And it didn't happen for Sarah through a whole host of things. There was injuries, there was illness. A lot of people kind of thought she'd probably step away from the sport, but she didn't, and she kept at it because she probably enjoyed it.
She's only 27.
27. I thought 27, 28. Yeah, gosh, I know.
I feel like she's been around, but she probably has because she's been following her since she's a junior.
That's the thing, because you look at junior and you think, wow, okay, and the name has been out there. And in fairness to her, like, you know, you got to give someone like that massive credit because she stuck at it. She obviously enjoyed it, you know, enjoyed athletics, but there was plenty of moments where I'm sure she was just like, what am I doing? And in fairness to her, you know, even last year, the year before, you know, there was a few kind of green shoots in there. Times were beginning to come around, but she was consistent in her training, and that would then transferred into performances. She made Tokyo, and she's literally carried that form now into the winter, into these indoor worlds. And it was a great run. And like, it has to be said, people were probably looking elsewhere for, you know, the positives that maybe going into the champs, where will we get a finalist, who would run well. And people probably looked at Sarah kind of, what was it, 8.06 she ran recently, which suddenly, boom, okay. And I was chatting to her last week before the Worlds, and she was like, she felt she'd never been as good form going into a championship. And when you're in that sort of frame of mind, that mindset, she performed really well in the heat, opened up huge opportunity into a semi-final, and then knowing that like she'd have to go quicker. And she was just in a really competitive race. She was out in lane 8, which is, again, probably worked in her favour because she could run her own race, you know, and she wasn't maybe, you know, on top of people left and right. And lo and behold, she runs 7.97 and qualifies for World Final. So that's a huge run, massive championship. And in this year as well, with Europeans and Worlds, like, that's massive momentum to bring into the spring and into the summer.
I suppose what we forget is all you can expect of anybody is to try their best. And when Sarah got a personal best in that semi-final, I mean, what more can you expect, want or ask of anybody?
Exactly. And it's also doing it when it really matters, i.e. a world stage. Like, it's one thing going out to Abbottstown and when the pressure's not essentially on you to perform, but then going into a championship where you're up against like world class athletes and you're on that start line, and to produce your best when it really matters is a really important thing from a championship perspective.
What other positives did you see? We had teenage sprint star Israel Olatunde. He had a strong 60 metre heat, and he's very young as
19.
Well, so yeah.
19, like, it's like Israel again is a coming force in terms of sprinting in Ireland, and again 60 metres, 100 metres, that's probably where he's going to be, not maybe 200, but you're looking at that strength in depth and who he's bringing along. There's a couple of other names that are running fast times, so from a relay perspective, again, going to World Championships, he performed reasonably well last year in the Europeans, but he's progressed so much this year. Like, he's 0.01 off Paul Heschen's long-standing 60 metre record, and we all know what Hesch did for sprinting in Ireland over 100 and 200. So for Israel to get close to that, he's been really consistent, and I think people were kind of hoping maybe he could nip inside that record, but he performed very, very well, and he'll take a lot going from these championships. So again, that's a really positive performance. And then you've obviously got Molly Scott in the women's 60 metres, who has been trading Irish records with Rashida Adelecki, who's based over in the States. Rashida wasn't here in Belgrade because of her collegiate commitments, you know, and she's on scholarship over in Texas, and that's the priority. She got NCAAs indoors last week. She performed very well, and obviously has NCAAs in June, so we won't really see a whole lot of Rashida until post June, come back home and get involved in the European circuit. So you know, when you look at Molly, you look at that record, like 7.27, it's come right down to 7.17. Molly's 7.19. It was great, you know, over the last couple of weeks, when you consider, you know, she'd break the record, then Rashida would break the record.
And so far away from each other.
So
as well.
Far away, yeah. Like, it's almost like two boxes. We can't wait for the actual head-to-head. And I think Molly going into that, everyone maybe kind of expected or even hoped that she might kind of find a couple of hundreds and grab that record. But she performed well. She qualified out of the semi-final, or sorry, into the semi-final. And I think it was 7-7, 7-23 or something like that. So it wasn't a bad performance by any means. And again, that's someone who is just currently riding a wave of good form, and hopefully she can bring that into the season. So I think when you look at those two, then you've got Phil Healy, who won her semi-final. She won her heat, which was impressive. 51, I think it was, like, you know, just one of her fastest times. Again, doing that in the World Championships in her heat, setting up a semi-final. The hard thing about 400 at Worlds or indoors is you got two rounds in one day, and I think to be fair to Phil, it was touch and go whether she'd be there at all. It was touch of COVID leading into it, and I think you could see that in the semi-final race, which was only hours after the heat. You know, when you run that fast in the morning to come back and replicate that, but when you look at the time, she wasn't far away overall, and I think that is another one of our athletes that is actually in really, really good form going into a huge summer. So I think those probably will be the standout kind of positives. I think the relays will be looked at, both men's and women's 4x4s. They all ran national records, but I think when you look at the quality that was in that competition overall, I think there was good opportunity there that we just didn't kind of maximise and get into a final. But some individual legs were fast. And again, you're looking at building at those relays going forward. It has to be, you know, because it just widens that pool of talent. And if we can build on that, we saw last year in Tokyo with the mixed relay. So, yeah, those are probably the positives.
What are the negatives?
And then the negatives, yeah. And, like, yeah, look, it's expectation, kind of managing our expectations going in. I think when you look at the races and that didn't go our way, you got to look at kind of the middle distance, you know, the two lads, I suppose, in the 1500, Luke McCann, Andrew Coskren. And look, I interviewed them afterwards, and they were downbeat. They weren't happy with the performances. Like, the times weren't overly quick, and the way the races were ran, they kind of both felt they probably should have been more in the mix. They both have good seasons. Likewise, Sarah Healy, good season, but was just cut adrift pretty early in a race and just wasn't really in the mix to qualify. And the qualification, again, has to be said, it was really tough at these. Like, in the men's, it was like the winner of each semi-final. So the first person crossed the line and then a couple of fastest losers. So, you know, it's tough at that level, but I think all athletes have to look at it and take something from it. You know, there's one thing doing it on the circuit when you have a rabbit in front of you, a pacer, and it's bringing around the fast time, but tactically, and that's what's really important going into championships, is how you run your race. Yes, you could be physically fit, but also you got to have the head in there as well and run smart. And I think some of them maybe just didn't have that, and hopefully they can take something from it. But they are in good form. I think our athletes are in good form. PBs, national records this summer, Commonwealths, Worlds and Europeans, all in the space of, you know, less than 2 months. So it's a huge summer of athletics and massive opportunities.
It annoys me when I watch people interviewed after something has gone wrong and they are picking the positives rather than just being honest. And I listened to you interviewing Andrew Coskren and Luke McCann, and I admired their honesty and their disappointment, and felt that they can take the right thing from this to be better. Do you see it that way too, or do you believe you should be finding the positives and never looking at the negatives?
I agree 100% with you. I think, you know, Luke and his dad, Clark, who coaches him, they won't mind me telling you this, but, like, Luke was like a bull in the mix zone. Like, he was really disappointed, and, you know, it was one of those moments, right? Like, go take a couple of minutes and come back to us. But I thought he was very honest in his assessment. I thought Dara McElhenney was very honest in assessment. I think they all were, to be fair. Sarah Healy, you know, Mark English, they all were really honest, which is quite refreshing. You know, it's almost like being there is not enough anymore. They want to go there and they want to perform. And I think that's a huge statement. And I agree, Ruby, like, there's a time where you sit down, you debrief, and you look at the positives, what worked, what didn't work, what do we need to do? But, like, to go to a world and not perform, it's going to sting. And you want to see that, because then you get the hunger, then you get the motivation to come back and sit down and go, right, that's not going to happen to me again. I'm going to change things. I'm going to work on this, work on that, and find something. Because that's where, I suppose, the purpose comes into it, and then the actions and away you go. And I think you have to take that after a championship and lead that into what is going to be a huge summer. It's the Europeans. You know, it's a huge opportunity for a lot of our young athletes to get major outdoor experience, but also to get through the rounds and hopefully maybe be in the hunt for a medal.
When you looked at the Worlds then indoors outside of Ireland and you looked at the great championships the Ethiopians had, I must say I was shocked to see a Swiss athlete win the 60 metres women's. But yeah, overall, what sort of a championship was it?
Yeah, well, it was our first championship where we had crowds back in the stadium. So that was great. It was probably, from a spectator point of view, it was a bit slow to get going. I think when you look at Serbians and what they were kind of looking for was the women's long jump. You had Spanovic, her married name is Valletta, I think. She was the home favourite, and that all came to the fore on a Sunday. And she performed, and the place went wild. That was amazing. Duplantis in the pole vault on Sunday, world record 6:20, and these are things we throw numbers out like 6:20 as if we know what it's about, and even me, but you know, because I'm working at these events, I rarely get the time to sit down and actually watch this. Mm-hmm. But I did on Sunday because we didn't have any Irish competing, and 6:20, it's like 1.5 double decker buses. It is ridiculously high, and to see him do that in the flesh was phenomenal. You mentioned like Kambunji in the women's 60 metres again, huge performance in a final, massive personal best. That was fantastic. You had Rojas in the women's triple jump again. When you see someone like triple jump over 15 metres, like, it's these distances will mean nothing to people at home, but like, get a measuring tape out, measure out 15 metres and see what it's like, actually just look at it and go, oh my god, a human like triple jumped or jumped that far. Those were the big things. Grant Holloway in the men's 60 metres as well, he equaled his own world record in the semi-final. You know,
Ingebrigtsen not winning,
yeah,
getting COVID afterwards,
first championship without his dad as a coach. You know,
of course,
yeah,
yeah.
That's the fella who has been unbeaten. He ran the world record indoors this year over 1500 metres. He came to Dublin in December and won the Eurocross. He is a superstar. Yeah. And like, you know, Ruby mentioned the Ethiopians there as well, and you see what they did in the 1500. They beat Ingebrigtsen, and it was a really interesting run because, like, watching that, Kipsang the Kenyan went out from the line, he took it out, and you could see Ingebrigtsen kind of looking around going, what's happening, what's going on? And it was almost like the Kenyans and the Ethiopians maybe had a pact, we're going to work together and get rid of this fella.
Do you think it was COVID though, because he didn't have that kick at the end? You could, yeah, kind of see towards the,
but sometimes, you know, when you look at Ingebrigtsen, like, probably, and I was chatting to a few other people about this, like, his last kind of 50 to 100 metres can sometimes be his weak point. But okay, the problem is that nobody can stick with him to that point. So he burns them off early. That didn't happen. Maybe it was COVID. Like, he did tweet that. Yeah, he picked up COVID. And interestingly enough, like, we had our COVID issues, the likes of Phil Healy, Mark Innes, all got COVID in the last couple of weeks. And I think this year, we're going to see a lot of this. You know, outside of sport, you see the numbers increasing. So when you have a lot of athletes on the circuit travelling around, going
and the
bubbles
aren't as strong, and the restrictions are gone.
So it's another thing that athletes are going to have to factor in this year.
It surely is. I was really taken back by Rojas 15:74. I was thinking you should really try yourself, skip, hop, and jump, and see where you land, and then realise.
Could you
make the pitch?
She was.
Could you video yourself doing that, please, yeah, and send it to me?
I don't think so, but I did think it was interesting to watch the 60 metre sprint final, David, and how long it took them to split Jacobs and Coleman. I mean,
yeah,
it just dragged on longer than it would in the racers.
Yeah, it would. You're right. And the tension. And obviously there's like a subplot to this, like Coleman coming back from a drugs ban. Jacobs not competing since he's basically won the Olympic last year. He didn't compete after that. He did a couple of indoors and it was real head to head. And even though the race, the way it unfolded, you know, it was just dead heat on the line, and even in the stadium it was really slow to come up, so the tension kind of built. And I think a lot of people were delighted to see Jacobs win because of Coleman's background and kind of coming back after a drugs ban. They didn't want to see him win, but that's the competition. And when you have close races like that and fast races, that was a really fast run, you know, it all adds to it. It was great to kind of have fans back in the stadium, and indoors is great for that, you know, because it's timetables condensed, there's a lot of action happening, there's a lot of stuff going on, and I think overall it was a welcome return for athletics.
So what's next? What can we look forward to over the next few months?
Yeah, well, obviously, like right now, the athletes will come back from the indoors, take stock, resume their kind of end of winter training into the spring. And then you're looking at a huge summer. Like I mentioned, you've got Munich Europeans in August. Prior to that, you've got Worlds over in Oregon, which were meant to be last year, but they've been put onto this year, and you've obviously got the Commonwealth as well. So obviously Commonwealth doesn't really affect us, but it affects some of our athletes. So the likes of Kieran McGinn potentially will have three major championships this summer. So it's all about how they plan, what they're going to do, what they're going to focus on. Very hard to do three championships in a season. So, you know, even going all the way over to Oregon, it's a long way away. You come back and you've got about a week turnaround into Munich. And the Europeans are obviously where we can do something. And I think when you look at the relays, you look at the mixed relay last year, there's a lot of talent there. You look at maybe a 4x1, the likes of Israel coming through. You got Molly, Rashida, all these kind of big names. We could hopefully be up there challenging in the relays. And then you look at the national records that we're running individually as well. I think there's a lot of people that would be looking at Europeans to progress their career, get that experience and get through rounds. And if we can get a few into the semis and hopefully sneak into finals, like, you know, I'd be looking at a really good championship.
We surely will. And then it all builds to the Dublin Marathon in October.
That's where it's at.
Thanks a million for coming in.
RTE 2FM. On 2FM.
Welcome back. It is time now to talk European football, and Fergal Brennan is with us on the line. Fergal, good to talk to you on a Tuesday.
I'm on the phone.
You're on the phone, you are.
Hello.
How are you, Fergal?
Sorry.
Were you doing that? I do that to my kids
very
all
good.
The time.
Yourself?
As well. Get out, I'm on the phone, close the door.
I hope yours listen.
You just caught me in the middle of that one.
You're grand. So look, we're European football on a Tuesday, and it's actually great to be here talking about Barcelona and putting a positive spin on how they're getting on. So to see them doing so well in El Clasico the other night against Real Madrid was a bit of a surprise, really.
It was. It was a bit of a statement in terms of where they find themselves in the final few weeks and months of the season. If you think back to the start of the campaign and Ronald Koeman, Lionel Messi leaving and the real negative air that was just hanging around the club, the fan base and Real Madrid, without exactly tearing it up, just did what Carlo Ancelotti does so well, winning games, being very comfortable, being very straightforward and just ticking enough boxes to make sure that they just power on and power on. And this performance and the result, it sends a message. I think if they'd gone to Madrid and won 1 or 2-0, that says to Madrid, next season, we're going to be there. We're going to be, you know, keeping you honest and challenging you all the way. Going to Madrid, winning 4-0, it's the first time they've won in 5 games, first time they've won in Madrid since 2019. That says, not only are we going to be with you next season, we're going to be challenging you and we're going to be possibly better than you, because we've got a team full of young, exciting players. Xavi obviously has returned as manager. There's a crop of players coming through Barcelona now that are arguably as good as the one that he came through when he was a player.
It will be great to see, but look, January transfers can go one way or the other, but Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, he's certainly having an impact.
He is, and he's the kind of the tip of the sword for them, because they have all these fantastic young players and so much creativity and speed with the likes of Dembele and Adama Traore that have got in on loan. They have maybe lacked someone with that cold experience of when a chance falls their way, they can just stick it in the back of the net. I still think that moving forward, Aubameyang, given his age, is not a long-term solution for Barcelona if they want to be winning La Liga and challenging in the Champions League. But in terms of the way that he's taken to it in Spain, he's been absolutely fantastic. I think, as I say, further down the line, they'll be looking to get Ansu Fati fit and one or two other of those young players, Ferran Torres, who's coming from Manchester City as well. But in terms of an immediate response that they wanted, they've got it. They're still in a position to win the Europa League. I think they're favourite, or certainly amongst the favourites. They should get top four in Spain. So it'll be a positive end to the season. And particularly, again, when you go back to the start of the campaign where everything was all doom and gloom, I think Xavi's done a very good job.
He sure has. They're 12 behind Real Madrid points, that is, with a game in hand, so maybe that's 9. But Mario Pochettino in PSG, they're 12 points clear of Marseille, but they were woeful at the weekend. Beaten 3-0 by Monaco, unacceptable and a sporting shame, was how Mario Pochettino described it.
Yeah, it was an awful performance, and they're actually in quite bad form in domestic action. They've already wrapped up the title. I think they probably need another 3 or 4 wins to just get that box ticked, but they're going to limp over the line. This is the only trophy that they can win. They're out of the French Cup, and obviously they've been dumped out of the Champions League by Real Madrid. So given the position that they're in, there is going to be changes this summer. Kylian Mbappe, I'll be absolutely shocked if he signs a contract extension. I think he's has more than 1 foot out the door. I think he's only got 1 foot left in Paris. Pochettino's position will be questioned. That's a big call for the club to make, because they've gone through so many different types of coach, chasing this holy grail of winning the Champions League, and none of it's worked. Pochettino's probably got them the closest of anyone. So they face a decision whether they want to go back to the drawing board. They probably won't, given the business model that they operate under of signing all these superstar Galactico players. They'll win the title, but it'll be an incredible... I was speaking to a journalist that works in France last week, and he said it'll be one of the most muted title celebrations of the last few years, because the expectation with Messi coming in was, this is the last piece of the jigsaw. Now, this is it for the Champions League. And they've just fallen quite a distance short once again.
And the fans are well capable of letting them know as well. They don't mind booing their big superstars. Mm. Do you think Messi is going to stay there?
I think, given the fact that he still has 12 months and PSG still have an option to extend that by another 12 months, I don't see a change. There was little whispers that maybe his agent would be speaking to Barcelona about the possibility of a bit of a, not quite tail between his legs return, because he's the greatest player of all time, but a return to Barcelona in a kind of ushered back in. But I think Xavi and Barcelona, despite the fact that it is Messi and what that represents, they're moving in a direction with these young players now that would be counterproductive to the wider message. And I think, just based on his decision to go to PSG, that's the decision that he made, that's the decision that he took, and I don't really see it being reversible. And I think the only options, either this summer or next summer when his contract expires, would be a move back to Argentina, which would be obviously a bit of an emotional thing for him. I don't see him being the type to go and play in China or somewhere like that. I think it'll either be back to Argentina or maybe calling it a day.
Froggle, I read a good story about an 18-year-old Scottish young fellow today, Aaron Hickey, who has joined Bologna, who could have went to Bayern Munich, left Hearts in 2022, Villa were interested, Celtic were interested, but he went to Bologna, he's playing first team football, and now he's in the Scottish squad for Thursday.
Yeah, he's absolutely flying. He's maybe a tiny bit unlucky that he's coming through into a Scotland squad that already has Andy Robertson and Kieran Tierney. But I think the big story, as you rightly say, is this move that he made to Bologna. Would have been very easy for him to take a championship or an English premiership move. He rolled his dice, he backed himself, and he went to Italy, and he's really, really performing. The Bologna fans really like having him there. He's become a bit of a cult icon for them, because it's a bit of a novelty having a Glaswegian playing in Serie A. So he is a really, really talented player. Scotland are obviously well stocked at left back. They've tried to move things around to fit Tierney and Robertson into the team. Hopefully, maybe there's some rejigging they can do to get him in. But the fact that he's doing so well in Serie A is proof that he made the right call. Rather than keeping it safe and just taking the long trodden path down to England, he took a chance and it's paying off.
Could be the way forward for many, many more. Fergal Brennan, thanks a million for taking our call. Marie, that is about all we have time for.